Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're going to slow things down a bit and share some stories that I think are often overlooked. It might be easy to miss lots of things at a flea market, and many folks see it as junk, but one man makes art out of the things he finds at flea markets.
Maybe some of this stuff carries a little bit of the history or the spirit of the people that used it or worked with it or made it.
And have you ever heard of Dr. Enough? It's an energy drink made in Johnson City, Tennessee, and in that community, it's really popular.
It's almost like having celebrity status when people find out that I work for Dr. Enough. It's, oh, this is the lady that makes Dr. Enough, or this is Dr. Wanda. That's how I'm introduced.
We'll also hear part of one woman's story about battling cancer and struggling to pay for care.
People just need to know that just because they're going through things, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be stuck there for a lifetime.
You'll hear these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In this week's episode, we'll take a trip across our region and meet people in Tennessee, Kentucky, and Ohio. Each of today's stories highlight an element of life here in Appalachia that I think is often overlooked. We start with the story about a situation too many of our friends and neighbors are facing. Statistics show, and you're probably aware, that medical bills can be financially crippling. Those bills contribute to more than 60% of personal bankruptcies in the country. But how does this relate to homelessness? Mary Meehan has the story of one woman who lost her home while fighting cancer.
Christy Reyes' house in Frankfort, Kentucky is rarely quiet. Her grandson, Jalen, squeals, running from room to room. The family is together now, but were apart as Reyes was diagnosed with cancer and struggled to pay for care and keep a job.
Even though I had medical, there was things that medical didn't cover that I had to pay out of pocket for.
She remembers the day she was diagnosed, January 3rd, 2012. She managed to work most of that year, but she cycled through a lot of jobs. She'd need time off for procedures, miss work because of side effects. Shortly before Christmas of that year, she'd run out of options and money. At first, she and three kids lived in the car, and soon she had to let her children live with other family and friends.
I don't care how much money you make. Money is never enough when you're sick like that.
She remembers after surgery to remove cancerous lymph nodes, trying hopelessly to recover in her car. The chemo drugs were damaging her organs, she says. Eventually, she was too sick for treatment to even continue.
My body felt like it couldn't handle anymore.
Reyes' experience is not unique. There are some 1,500 people in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio who are homeless, and many more living on thin financial margins. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says half of rural Americans say they could not afford to pay an unexpected bill of $1,000, and a third have had trouble paying medical bills.
We have a saying, housing is health care.
That's Jessica Suchik, Director of Homeless Services for the Health Center Health First Bluegrass. She says stable housing is essential to health.
And without that, it's like, you know, building a house on sand. We have to have that stability. You have to have that landing place. You have to have that safety and that security blanket of safe, stable, and affordable housing.
Health First has adopted a team approach, with each patient having a medical provider, a social worker, a case manager, and a psychiatrist. Suchik says it's made all the difference.
The magic that happens when you address not just the physical health issues, but also the things that are preventing them from getting those physical health issues addressed, is really, that's where it's at.
Dr. Steffi Woolhandler is co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. The group advocates for a single-payer system, such as the Medicaid for All proposals advanced by Democratic presidential candidates Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. She says such programs in other countries help people like Reyes avoid homelessness due to medical bills.
In fact, virtually every other developed country guarantees health care to everyone living there. This is true in Europe, it's true in Canada, and it's true in Australia. The United States is an outlier.
After 4 years without a home, most of that time living away from her kids, Reyes says she couldn't take it anymore. Her muscles atrophied from always sitting in the car. One day last fall, exhausted, she parked by the banks of the Kentucky River and prayed. She called the Salvation Army and was told to walk into the Frankfurt offices of the Housing and Homeless Coalition of Kentucky. 2 months later, she had a new home and a new peace of mind.
I was actually approved for a lifetime assistance. So that made it even better, because I know no matter the struggles of my health or the battles that I gotta fight with it, I'm always gonna have that support.
Holding her grandbaby in her lap with her teenage son playing video games in the next room, she's content. There is food in the pantry. There are 4 bedrooms filled with people she loves. A simple secondhand dining room table is now her favorite place to be. Looking back, she realizes she was in denial about just how sick she was, and she hopes other people will take some comfort in knowing things can change for the better.
Even on the days where you feel everything's hopeless and you feel that there is no upside to anything, like, you still find that that little bit of energy, that little bit of strength to get up and be like, okay, I'm not going to give in today. People just need to know that just because you're going through things, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be stuck there for a lifetime.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan in Frankfort, Kentucky.
Thriving. That's something many people across the country struggle with, too. And while it appears America's economy is doing fairly well, the Labor Department released a report this month that shows the country is experiencing record low unemployment. Yet there are still thousands of people who are living in poverty. In fact, the Appalachian Regional Commission released a report this summer that shows much of Appalachia is still struggling with low employment and high rates of poverty. One of those communities is Breathitt County, Kentucky. The ARC has labeled it economically distressed. Still, residents there know there's more to their story, like how their grandma takes care of them and how a new program is helping to take care of some of grandma's traditions. It's called Our Breathitt, and it's improving the health and well-being of some people. As WEKU's Sherry Lawson reports, the idea is to use arts and culture to help residents recognize the beauty in everyday Breathitt County life.
The fourth grade art class at Highland Turner Elementary is enthusiastic about a guest teacher who's presenting a special project to them. It's a warm fall day, and Ray Goodwin, professor at the University of Kentucky's School of Art and Visual Studies, is here for the second time.
Today we're going to do a project where you get to transform your grandmother into a superhero.
All of the children, including Haley Terry, Macy Miller, Austin Wagers, and Tanner Stamper, are responding to questions such as, what does Grandma like? What annoys you about her? What kinds of things do you do with her? And what do you love about her?
She helps me with my homework and stuff. She likes to bake.
She plays video games with me, watches movies, takes me to the park.
I love that every time I come to her house, she'll always give me hugs and kisses.
Goodwin is one of the artists working with an initiative referred to as Our Breathitt. It began in 2017, using arts and culture as a way to create health and well-being. Funded by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, the effort is a collaboration of several organizations and individuals in the region. The artist-led programs include things like poetry, writing, music, and gardening. Highland Turner Elementary's arts and humanities teacher, Scott Holland, likes the idea of the students celebrating culture and heritage through art. He says grandmas are important figures in Breathitt County.
Grandma here in Appalachia is doing a whale of a job. She is, in fact, the matriarch raising the family still yet, even the grandchildren. A lot of those responsibilities have fallen onto her, and she's doing a great job.
Still, Ray Goodwin says Breathitt County is one of the counties at the center of the opioid crisis, where economic opportunities are slim and are fading.
It absolutely has been impacted through loss of jobs in the region and the opioid epidemic and other health consequences, including food scarcity and generational poverty. So it is a place that is of great need and of great strength all at the same time.
Theo Edmonds, assistant professor at the University of Louisville's School of Public Health, is from a 9-generation family in Breathitt County. Edmonds was doing the work of using arts and culture as a way to create and improve well-being in Louisville and Natchez, Mississippi. It made sense to introduce the concept in Breathitt County. He says Our Breath It, at its essence, is meant to identify what is working. Edmund says if you approach community members with a survey, they're only going to tell you so much. But, he says, writing poetry and making music together can yield valuable information.
What I have often seen is that when you start with meaning, when you start with culture, when you understand what is meaningful to people and you build from there, you begin to build capacity. Some things can happen. It's not going to happen overnight, though.
Earlier this year, writer and poet Pauletta Hansel returned to Breathitt County, where she grew up. As part of Our Breathitt, Hansel spent 3 days writing poetry with students at Breathitt County High School. She asked them to sketch out the important places in their community and write about it.
This is my homeland, one person wrote. Another wrote, you know, this is the place that made me. This is the place I'll always come back to.
Another person involved with and inspired by Our Breathitt is third-generation quilt artist and Breathitt County native, Shana Nilyu. The 32-year-old was instrumental in making 2 separate quilts for the high schools in the county for graduation. One was 30 feet long with 120 pieces. The large quilts created a panoramic view of the region.
And each student, as they came into graduation, had a piece of the quilt draped over their shoulder. And as they walked across the stage, they handed that piece of the quilt off to somebody else who then put it up. So as these people were walking across the stage graduating, this mosaic of their school was building behind them.
At the end of the day, says Theo Edmonds, Our Breathitt is an arts and culture experience focused around health and well-being. The 9th generation Breathitt County and attributes it to the folks of Breathitt County who say we're not only going to survive, but to thrive. In Breathitt County, I'm Sherry Lawson.
But I'm from Breathitt County, and I think it is God's country. If you ever get the chance, you ought to go. And it looks like I'm finally going back home.
I'd love to see that quilt. And what a neat idea and inspiring story to hear of people committed to this place and sharing our unique stories that help explain why we want to visit. After all, it's not just the opioid epidemic. National media have long reported on the economy in Appalachia that's followed the boom and bust cycles of the coal industry for decades. There's no denying it's a part of our region. Like so many other folks in this area, I'm so proud to tell folks that my daddy was a coal miner or my grandfather was a member of the UMWA. But we do have strengths and skills here that go beyond coal. Arts and culture isn't usually the first thing policymakers think of when trying to find solutions to economic struggles. But did you know that in the 1960s, as part of Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty effort, a New Yorker came to Letcher County, Kentucky. As a way to help bring more economic opportunity to the region, he set out to teach women the craft of making hooked rugs. The practice has been part of the American craft culture for more than 200 years, according to an article in the Chicago Tribune. It used to be that women did the work to earn extra money for their families. Next, we're going to hear an extended interview with the daughter of one of those women, Mary Gail Adams, the daughter of Josephine Whitaker. Whitaker was one of the founding members of a group called the Hound Dog Hookers. Hookers, as in a group of women from Blackie, Kentucky, who made handmade hooked rugs throughout the 60s and 70s. They became nationally known. WMMT's Mimi Pickering sat down with Mary Adams to record her story. Let's listen to part of their conversation.
There's the label. It says Hound Dog Hookers, Blackie, Kentucky, homemade in Letcher County by, and then whoever would make the rug would put their name on it. And this one says Joe Whitaker, member of Kentucky Guild of Artists and Craftsmen. When they first started making the labels, she'd tear up sheets and make the labels out of some old white sheets. About 6 years ago, Grace at the library had called me and said, there's this woman who is trying to get in touch with someone about the Hound Dog Hookers, and she's going to be contacting you about a rug. I said, okay. This lady emails me and says, I'm from somewhere in Ohio, and I had been to a vendor's mall in Indiana, and I found this rug, and it has a label on it that said Hound Dog Hookers, Blackie, Kentucky. So she begins to inform me that she has a hound dog rug I asked her, is there a label on the back that has someone's name on it? And she says, yes. I said, whose name is on the label? And she said, Josephine Whitaker. And my heart just drops out of my chest. And I said, is it in good shape? And she said, it's in perfect shape. And she does not know that I would probably pay her any amount for this rug. And I had it within a week. And when I opened the box it was in, I just melted into the floor. And I just couldn't believe it. And it's in perfect shape. And this rug is probably 35, 40 years old. So I was thrilled. My sister's so jealous. She said, now we got to keep looking and see if we can find another one. And so I have two of them back that are in mint condition that have been gone from this house, this very house, for probably 40 years. So hopefully they're coming back home where they need to be. And I know there's more of them out there because they sold so many. I would buy back as many of them as I could with my mom's name on them. My name is Mary Gail Adams. We're in Blackie, Kentucky. And I have lived in this house almost since I was 5 years old. So I grew up here. My mother, Josephine Whitaker, was the most self-sufficient, hardest working woman I ever knew. And I know people say that about their families, but she was. She could do 40 things at once and keep them going. She knew more stuff than anybody I ever knew about everything. From as far back as I can remember, my dad was a coal miner who got out of work in the early 60s. And then we bought this house and moved here from Leatherwood in about 62, I think. And she had already gotten involved with the Hound Dog Hookers through Marianne Adams. Because Marianne Adams is actually, I think, the one who actually got it started. Dr. Lundy Adams, his wife. I'm assuming she just thought it was a way to supplement their income. So I think that's the reason we moved here closer. A gentleman by the name of George Wells, he was from New York City. He came here to kind of try to help to fight that war on poverty that was started. And he was a rug maker and an artist and all this stuff. So he thought of a way to help women make money by teaching them how to make rugs. So he came here and started teaching classes on how to hook rugs and how to do shading and colors and that kind of thing. And then he had a contest. He knew he wanted to call it Hound Dog Hookers. He said, I'm going to have a contest to draw a hound dog. And whoever draws the best hound dog, that's the one we're going to use, and we're going to make a rug, a hound dog. Mom could draw, and so Mom got on to that. And so my sister tells me that she didn't have big enough paper. So she went to this grocery store that's close to where we lived, and she got them to give her the brown paper that they wrap meat in, a big piece of that, which is long and narrow. Paper being narrow, she had to keep shortening his legs. So she finally got it erased and got it drawn to where she liked it. And so she submitted that, and that's the one that won. That's how the hound dog started.
We've been listening to Mary Gail Adams, whose mother was one of the original members of a group of women in eastern Kentucky who became nationally recognized for hooked rugs. Next, we'll hear Adams talk about some of the customers who bought and commissioned these rugs, including one that lived in the White House.
George Wells got them connected with organizations. They became part of the Craft Guild at the time. There was a store in Louisville, I remember the lady that was involved a lot, sold a lot of them for them. It was called the Sign of the Pine Tree. George Wells also helped them start to go places to teach other women how to make them. So I can remember going with Mom lots of places, and we wouldn't get home until late at night. And for a little girl that never went anywhere, that was a real treat for me. They were in lots of travel brochures and things like that somehow. And then people would just show up here from Wisconsin or Vermont or, and they go, you know, we were traveling and we found this Hound Dog Hookers at Blackie, Kentucky, and we were very interested and we wanted to see your work. And the mom would show them all this, and sometimes they'd commission one. Some person, I have no idea who, commissioned a snake, just a laid out long snake. Why you'd want that, I don't know. Some person commissioned one of their poodle, one of some turtles in a circle. Just weird ones, you know, that they only made one time. But now, most of like these were made repeatedly over and over and over and over. And then Lady Bird Johnson, I'm not sure how she found out, she commissioned, I think, three. When Lyndon Johnson was still president, there was one she commissioned, that was in the White House. Of course, one was of his beagles. And another one was of an eagle with the leaf things on it for the White House. And then there's one they commissioned with wildlife on it. It was huge. That, I'm told, is in his museum in Texas. And they did not make a lot of money. So no, they didn't sell for much. This one behind me might have sold for $78, $75. The hound dog was probably $60-some. I want to say the big one for Lyndon Johnson, I want to say it was $1,500. And there was no vacation and there was no time off, so it was all the time. And there was no slumps. I mean, there was no months that went by that they didn't make them, because someone was always commissioning them. But they were sold all over this country. Mom did it from about 1962, I'm going to guess, until about 77 or 78. And then her and the other two ladies, I think, were just tired. They just stopped. I would have a lot more of her stuff if she hadn't gotten rid of it. A prison, and I don't know how this came about either, but a prison here in Kentucky had contacted her. And this person was in charge of the recreational part of the prison. And he had heard about these people that made rugs. And they decided they wanted their prisoners to learn how to make rugs. And he wanted to know how to get started. And she was so done with this, she sold him just about everything she had. And what she didn't sell him, she burnt. They had to be perfect. And she put hours and hours of work into the design, getting the shading just right. She would go in, maybe change a leaf or change the way an eye looked on a fox. Each color, everything had to be exact. I think she enjoyed it.
That was Mary Gail Adams speaking about the Hound Dog Hookers, a group of women from Letcher County, Kentucky, who made handmade hooked rugs in the 1960s and 70s as a way to earn extra income. It's believed to help supplement the family income during downturns and coal jobs. Thanks to WMMT's Mimi Pickering, who recorded that conversation. Adams was able to find one of her mother's original rugs because someone had found one at an indoor flea market in nearby Ohio. I love flea markets. I can remember as a kid taking my cash to look for those one-of-a-kind items. And I can remember my daddy and lots of folks in my family often saying that some inexpensive items that we had in our home, we should hold on to because it might be worth some money someday. It seemed like a treasure hunt. And I felt so smart for paying a fraction of the cost for clothes and other items. Today, I still enjoy the hunt, but hosting a yard sale or setting up as a flea market has also been a way to make ends meet in tougher times. I don't like to waste, and of course, it's good for the environment to recycle, so it's a win-win for me. Flea markets are pretty common across Appalachia. Maybe you even remember your family hosting or shopping at them as a kid. There's usually something for just about everyone, including art collectors. One West Virginian artist mines flea markets regularly to find material for his work. Old photographs, children's toys, and tin cans of all kinds become elements in his abstract art, art that uniquely ties elements of Appalachian life into one place. Our Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan brings us the story.
Walking through the Rogers, Ohio flea market, the rows of outdoor vendors seem endless. There's a distinct smell of barbecue chicken in the air, and it wafts through the long tables displaying everything from long-forgotten toys to brand-new white tube socks to photo albums filled with strangers' memories.
All fresh stuff here. Find something you like. Come out of old estate. Just got this stuff yesterday.
It's just across the border from West Virginia, in the heart of the Rust Belt. Robert Villamagna comes here every other Friday, and he's been doing that off and on for almost 40 years. He was named West Virginian Artist of the Year in 2016, and much of the materials he uses he finds at Rogers Flea Market. Vendors know him so well, they sometimes set certain items aside for him.
Got something for you.
What do you got?
That's free.
Oh, free?
Yeah, it's free.
This is Mike Rossetti, and he's a regular merchant at Rogers. He saved an old children's noisemaker made out of tin for Robert. It's brightly colored with a painted dancing cartoon in the middle.
Well, I know he makes tin sculptures and pictures and stuff, so I saw that and figured he could use it.
Robert's primary art medium is patterned tin, like what's used to make old chip cans or coffee canisters or toys. And there's an abundance at flea markets. Robert's wearing red circle-rimmed glasses and a gray fedora. He pulls a little red wagon to carry his treasures. Robert loves what he calls old junk. He says it adds another dimension to his art.
Maybe some of this stuff carries a little bit of the history or the spirit of the people that used it or worked with it or made it. In amongst the big story of the main piece of work, these little stories of these little bits and pieces of metal and found objects, they're coming through.
Robert works out of his studio in Wheeling, West Virginia. And back at that studio, directly behind his home, it looks like what Rogers Flea Market would look like if it were chopped up and condensed into a single large room.
Oh, this is more than lived in. Actually, I call it organized chaos.
It's not messy, but over the years, he's amassed a lot of material. The room is filled with deconstructed flea market finds in labeled boxes. Like, take one bin, for example, which is marked blue plastic eyes from stuffed animals. Robert spends a lot of time breaking down objects, especially tin, into small pieces he can use for his art. For example, a large coffee can will become a dozen flattened pieces. He uses shears to cut out words or patterns or colors he likes.
Here I've got some nice white. I might need that for something. So I put it over my white box. Okay. And then there's red boxes. You can see that. And gray and brown and all that, so I can pull this stuff out. And then there's more bins with colors. Over here is a lot of patterns.
Some of his work resembles sculptures, but a lot of it is like a painting. Except instead of paint, he uses metal pieces to create an image. His pieces are bold, brightly colored, with a bit of a modern art flair. Sometimes he includes words or other materials, like buttons off a doll or old black and white photographs. Robert is comfortable working with tin because in some ways it's a part of him. He grew up next to a steel mill in Ohio, not far from Rogers Flea Market. He worked many different jobs in his life, but he spent 13 years in the steel mill. Robert says he was depressed, and his boss picked up on it.
And he said, well, where would you rather be? And I said, well, I'd rather be working as an artist or making art or somehow in the arts. And he says, why don't you make art about this place? And I thought, you got to be kidding me. Make art about the mill. I couldn't wait every day to walk out of there and just punch out. I mean, and make art about it? No way.
But he couldn't resist. During breaks, he started painting portraits of his fellow steel mill workers on the brick walls on the mill with fluorescent marking paint.
We called it the Hall of Laborers.
Now as a professional artist, Robert's work still reflects issues within Appalachia. One of his finished pieces peeks out from behind a stack of boxes in his studio. It's called Old King Coal. It has a wooden square frame about 4 feet tall, lined with license plates from Appalachian states. And the image inside is made up of different colored tin pieces, each nailed carefully into place.
It's a big hunk of coal crying, all right, and he's wearing a crown, and he's crying. He's on crutches. And in the background, you see windmills. And then down below his feet, he's stepping over a gas line.
The overall idea being the gas industry is overtaking energy production in Appalachia, which is oddly reflected in the flea markets, too. Rogers Flea Market is 90 minutes away from Robert's home in Wheeling, and that's the closest one to him. There used to be others, but in recent years they've shut down. Robert says he's noticed a lot of the land occupied with gas pipeline. So he makes the trip to Ohio religiously.
The flea market is calling and I must go. That definitely fits me.
Back at Rogers, he says sometimes things just speak to him, like this oversized baby doll. She's wearing a red and blue pajama and her face is plastic with painted on red cheeks and big blue eyes with eerily long eyelashes.
I got a feeling he's going home with me. It's somewhere between creepy, spooky, and wonderful. It's just going to have to be something. I don't know what.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Rogers, Ohio.
Not long after Caitlin visited the Rogers Flea Market, news hit that a fire had consumed the giant market. But we checked with Roger Villamagna, and he sent a photo of himself back at Rogers a few weeks later, wagon in tow. Apparently, it's a very resilient community, and they're back up in action, and the indoor section of the flea market is open year-round. Still to come.
We want some more? Okay.
We'll hear why having a meal with your children can start a habit of mindful eating.
And that communal way of eating is my favorite. And oftentimes, because of that, memories are created.
Also, have you ever heard of Dr. Enough Soda? It may be one of the first energy drinks in the country, and it's made right here in Appalachia. We'll hear that story and more in just a bit. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Okay, so what do you call sugary carbonated drinks? Soda or pop? Maybe soda pop? Or do you call all of it Coke, using it as a generic name regardless of what you're actually drinking? I looked it up, and the technical dictionary name is soft drinks. But there are studies that show that what you call carbonated soft drinks varies distinctly by where you grew up. Well, as a kid, it was always pop for me. Then, I think it was sometime in college that someone told me it was correctly called soda. So, eager to learn, I naively and blindly trusted this person and called it soda for a while. Well, be careful who you trust. Now, I'm back to saying pop. This brief flip-flop might be explained by the history of the region, though. In Appalachia, we tend to be a melting pot, a mixture of the South and the North. You may say soda while your neighbors call it Coke. Test it out and let us know how you say it, because we're curious. Our Twitter handle is @InAppalachia. Our email is insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. I bring this up because our next two stories are about soda, or pop, or whatever you call it. Today, energy drink companies like Red Bull and Monster are some of the most popular names across the country, and this industry is worth more than $12 billion. But a small family-run business in Johnson City, Tennessee, has been producing Dr. Enough for 70 years. Dr. Enough has been sold as a health tonic, and it does have some added vitamins. WETS's Fred Sossman has this story about one of the country's earliest energy drinks.
The original energy booster, Dr. Enough, the lemon-lime drink made by Tri-City Beverage in Johnson City, Tennessee, turns 70 this year.
My mother is 97 years old. And every day that I drop by, the first thing she's looking forward is to having her afternoon Dr. Enough. She has one every day.
Chuck Gordon can easily keep his mother supplied in Dr. Enough since he's now the company's CEO. Tri-City Beverage was started by his father, Charles O. Gordon Sr., shortly after World War II. The first brand of drink off the line was called Tip. And Tri-City Beverage later became the first franchisor of Mountain Dew and the first company to put the drink in commercial bottles. Mountain Dew would eventually be bought by Pepsi, but Dr. Enough has always been a Gordon family product. Charles Gordon came to know a man named Bill Swartz, who had graduated with a degree in chemistry from the University of Chicago. Hearing his co-workers complain about being tired all the time, Swartz developed the formula for what became Dr. Enough, and Gordon bought it.
Well, Mr. Bill Swartz was an interesting entrepreneur in himself, and he just had an idea to create a drink that replenished all the, I guess they call nutrients that your body had exhausted in a hard day's work. It was sold as a dietary supplement, a tonic, if you will, to something to pick you up, make you feel better, re-energize you. get you going for the rest of the day. And that's what Dr. Nuff was. It was in a 7-ounce bottle when most soft drinks were 10-ounce. We sold it in 4-packs for 98 cents. So that's basically 25 cents a bottle. And almost all soft drinks of the brands we all knew from back then were selling for only a nickel. So it really wasn't sold or marketed as a soft drink. It was sold as a dietary supplement, something to give you a boost, pick you up. I guess today it'd be called an energy drink.
Charles Gordon Sr. was a clever promoter of his products.
Back in the early 50s, with the help of the advertising gentleman at the Johnson City Press Chronicle, they created a full-page ad on the back of the paper. And the layout made it look like the front page, big extra across the top. And that whole page was about Dr. Nuff. And the story goes that they went out and slipped a few bucks or coins to the paper boys to fold them backwards so that when you opened them up, that was the front page, not the back page. Everyone thought that was the headlines of the paper that day.
Scott Lusk of Johnson City collects Tri-City beverage memorabilia.
It's probably the best advertising campaign I've ever seen in all my years in Johnson City.
Dr. Nuff drinkers have made all sorts of claims over the years about the drink's therapeutic powers.
And he had people writing in their testimonials and telling of all the ills that a bottle of Dr. Nuff would cure.
I can recommend Dr. Nuff as being the best tonic on earth for anyone who is weak, nervous, and has no appetite. Dr. Nuff will really give you new life.
A lot of it had to do with whether it was arthritis, a sour stomach, whatever that means, headaches, migraine headaches, just that worn down, tired feeling. We all grew up listening to Geritol ads, but I guess Dr. Nuff was right in that category. People would drink their Dr. Nuff and they claimed they were better. They felt better. They cured their ills. Now, I don't know how true that is, but certainly made them feel better.
These testimonial letters had claims of Dr. Nuff curing gout, upset stomach. This was written by a person named Heaton. I was bothered with my stomach, could not sleep at night. After taking 2 cartons of Dr. Nuff, I started feeling better. I can eat anything I want now that I am feeling better all the time. Would recommend Dr. Nuff to anyone who cannot eat but certain things and who is very nervous.
The image of Dr. Nuff was a little doctor with a derby hat and a black bag.
Wanda Braswell is Tri-City Beverages Senior Vice President for Administration, Finance, and Quality Assurance.
We have a family that drive here from South Carolina who swears that their mother doesn't have any UTIs since she's been drinking Dr. Nuff.
Charles Gordon always insisted that Dr. Nuff be bottled in glass.
We feel like glass preserves the best flavor. The carbonation stays in the glass bottle, whereas that comes out of plastic over time. Shelf life of a plastic bottle drink is only about 90 days. But shelf life of a glass, well-capped soft drink is a year or two. So we like it in glass. Our customers say it's better in glass. So we now only concentrate in Upper East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, Southeast Kentucky, Western North Carolina. Cracker Barrel does use Dr. Nuff in their old store nationwide.
Here's where we mix it up with the concentrate. Right now you see sugars being added. It's in a liquid form, pure cane sugar. Then all of the ingredients gets put in this vat. It's mixed very, very well before it's sent across the wall to the carbocooler, which then mixes it with the carbonation and everything else to go into the drink.
Tri-City Beverage has added an herbal Dr. Nuff flavored with cherry and a diet Dr. Nuff. The original formula, though, is much like Bill Swartz created it, with 246% of the recommended daily amount of thiamine and 85% of the recommended level of niacin.
And even though it's so popular in this area, I still meet people who've never tasted Dr. Enough, and that's just sad. And it's almost like having celebrity status when people find out that I work for Dr. Enough. It's, oh, this is the lady that makes Dr. Enough, or this is Dr. Wanda. That's how I'm introduced.
Wanda Braswell has worked for the Gordon family since 1977.
Tri-City Beverage and Dr. Enough is more than a business. It's a legacy.
For Inside Appalachia in Johnson City, Tennessee, I'm Fred Sausman.
It wasn't long ago that many small towns had their own soft drink bottling plants. A beverage bottling plant shut down just across the state line from me in Virginia, where more than 100 people lost their jobs just 7 years ago. I remember returning glass bottles to the grocery store for a little bit of change. My dad always kept up with it. RC was his favorite, and he liked it from a glass mason jar packed full of ice. The smell of RC after it bubbles around cold ice cubes still reminds me of my dad. And until about the year 2000, Whitesburg, Kentucky had its own RC Cola bottling plant. The plant has closed down, but the drink's marketing signs are still everywhere in the community. WMMT's Sydney Bowles brings us this story. It's part of an occasional series she does where people in the local community ask her questions and she goes searching for answers.
I moved to Whitesburg about 8 months ago, and one of the first things I noticed was people are really into RC Cola here. I had never heard of RC Cola, but here, all over the place, there are these signs for it. I figure if I have questions, you might too. So I enlisted Apple Shop filmmaker and amateur Letcher County historian Herbie Smith to help me figure it out.
Okay, so the way that the old regular Baptists address each other is as brother and sister. So that's the official, in fact, I think it's in one of their kind of basic ideas is that no one's above the other person. Everybody's a brother or a sister.
That's, I tell you to say something and that's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Yeah.
Sure, that checks out.
So the guy who owned the RC Cola bottling plant, take it right here, I'll show you. Was known as Brother Ray. Ray Collins was his name, but everybody called him Brother Ray. RC was probably the best-selling cola in Letcher County. And part of it was that Brother Ray was well-liked. People liked to do business with him. And it had all these RC signs all over the place.
Now, see, the real thing that I can't get over in this whole thing, all these signs around here say, in big letters, RC Cola, and then tiny, tiny letters underneath it, this church name or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it was part of his advertising strategy. It was when people would open even a country store or whatever, they would have this big display of maybe letters 4 feet tall that said RC and then under that Cola. And then there would be, and below that, there's just the name of the business would be hand-painted onto the sign. But it would be maybe, I don't know, less than 10% of the area of the sign was actually the name, and 90% was RC. I think the RC Cola, at least locally, of course we don't bottle it, go straight.
Okay.
We don't bottle soft drinks anymore, but the original idea was that the syrup, the concoction that made an RC, an RC or a Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, would come in concentrated form, and then they would add carbonated water locally.
So back in the day, there would have been, a lot of little towns would have bottling plants, right?
Yeah, all over.
When did that change, do you know?
I think this RC plant up here stayed the longest of any of them. And I was told that part of it was that they used a slightly different sweetener than other then like you could get cans of RC Cola, but it would have a slightly different ingredient than for sweetening than you could get at the local bottling plant.
So that gave them kind of a competitive advantage.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Hey, is Mr. Bentley here?
Mr. Bentley, he went home to cut grass.
Oh, okay.
Which Mr. Bentley are you looking for?
R.C. Cola Bentley.
That'd be Bradley Bentley. Bradley's passed away.
Yeah, but his son was...
Let's see, his son, Ronnie.
Yeah.
I don't know where Ronnie lives at.
Where was the bottling itself? Is it...
In the back.
In the back. Yep. Can I... What was it?
Brother, did you ever see the sign that used to sit down here by the entrance of the hospital? It said population plus, at that time, one grouch. And then it went to two grouches. I know there's one around by the old Coca-Cola plant.
Uh-huh.
The sign's still standing. I don't remember exactly what it says. Somebody stay in school, I think.
Yeah, stay in school.
Now, the one that never got put up was, R.C. Cola, Whitesburg, Kentucky. Attend the church of your choice. It's still in the back.
Where? In the back here? Can we see it?
Well, it's stacked up against the wall and that junk. This is a very dirty place. Now I'm watching for snakes.
Wow. They're
built up on, it's painted metal.
Welcome.
2x2 frame. Welcome to Whites. Right here's the attend, big RC in the middle. There's church.
Yeah. And that was hand painted too. Look at that.
Of your Royal Crown and big RC choice.
Do you drink RC?
It costs more than the rest of it.
What's your name? I'm sorry.
Ted Collins.
Ted Collins, it's really nice to meet you. I'm Sydney.
Sydney. This is the second Sydney I've seen today.
This town is not big enough for two Sydneys. We're going to have to fight it at some point.
No.
I'll see ya.
So this is RC. Okay, so we got...
Does it say where it's bottled?
12 cans.
Deed.
Produced under authority of Dr. Pepper 7-Up Incorporated.
Ooh. RC sold out.
Evidently, it's a part of Dr. Pepper now. Produced under the authority of Dr. Pepper 7-Up Incorporated, Texas. So
I think we should get a 2-liter bottle and take it back to the office and make everybody drink some.
After we got back from our trip, Herbie found out that Dr. Pepper, which bought RC Cola, got acquired by Keurig Green Mountain last July. The acquisition cost $18.7 billion. This is WMMT, and I'm Sydney Bowles.
And while pop produced right here in Appalachia does have its economic impact, there's no denying that there are health costs to drinking sugary drinks. These health risks are compounded by all the sugar we eat regularly, and perhaps even more during the holidays. Yet another story that's highly reported on and we're pretty familiar with is Appalachia's struggle with some of the highest rates of obesity in the country. A new way of thinking about food might help. Mary Meehan reports on the promise of a practice called mindful eating.
For this exercise, let's go ahead and close our eyes.
University of Kentucky Professor Dr. Giza Bruckner warns the class at the Lexington Healing Arts Center that meditation, while simple, may not be easy. The focus of the class is mindful eating.
Then I'd like you to just ever so slightly shift to the left, to the right.
Most of the class was middle-aged women, although there were a few men, and the strain showed on their faces as they tried to clear their heads.
For some of you, that may not be easy to do, and your mind may wander all over the place.
A health sciences researcher who studies things like the impact of probiotics on gut health, Bruckner has practiced mindfulness for decades and knows it can be powerful.
And you have to keep doing it. I mean, you have to be disciplined enough to continue on that path.
But can mindful eating fight obesity? Because the Ohio Valley has a problem. In Ohio, more than a quarter of adults are obese. In Kentucky, it's about a third. And in West Virginia, it's a little more than a third. Professor Emeritus at Indiana State University, Jean Christeller, has researched the relationship between mindful eating and health.
It doesn't have to be about the quantity. It can be about savoring the food. It can be about the quality of the food.
Christeller also wrote the book, The Joy of Half a Cookie. And she says it starts with science. After a few bites of a new food, our taste buds check out. Christeller says it's a chemical reaction, yet we keep chasing the flavor.
Those first few bites of ice cream tasted fabulous, but you weren't going to get that back by continuing to eat.
It also involves tradition, especially in places like Appalachia. As a therapist, she's worked with folks who've known real hunger.
They are the first or second generation out of a family where people really didn't feel like they had enough to eat.
Now food is all around us and cheaper than ever. You might not be able to wrangle cash for a Cadillac, but candy canes? They're $1.39 for a box of 12 at Kroger. But she says, if you're mindful, you can change those patterns. Half a cookie can feel like enough.
When you really learn to tune in, you realize you don't want the other half. And that's a huge shift.
Sarah Jane Sanders spent months thinking about food and culture for EAT.
Welcome to our home.
We talked with her at her home outside of Frankfort, Kentucky. EAT is a literary and photography exhibit on display at the Norton Center for the Arts in Danville, Kentucky at Center College.
I love having conversations over food and, you know, wine or tea and just the social event that is often surrounded by food.
A baker's dozen of written works were picked from some 200 submissions. Then Sanders crafted images to match the words. She found a consistent theme of food as a connection.
We want some more? Okay.
It's a connection she feels even stronger as she cares for her 8-month-old son, Taryn.
We also have peaches. And that communal way of eating is my favorite. And oftentimes, because of that, memories are created. And most of us, whether it be from smell or taste, can remember something from our childhood. And those memories that are surrounded by food are some of my favorite.
While her diet is now focused on locally grown fresh food, she still has a soft spot for comfort food some might find odd.
My friend Amy and I used to get up in the morning and we'd work at a horse farm together. And it was a tradition for us to go to the convenience store and buy a Dr. Pepper and Swiss rolls. And as we were cleaning stalls and taking care of horses, that is what we ate for breakfast.
Changing your view of the food you eat and how you eat it is all part of being mindful. And as Sanders' own evolution shows, we all have to start somewhere. For Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan in Richmond, Kentucky.
It can be difficult to see what we have when we have to work so hard to keep warm, eat, make it to work, and remember all the tasks and responsibilities of each day. But do we really need all that food? Or could we focus more on smaller portions that provide more nutrition? For a long time, maybe since the war on poverty, it seems America's culture is focused on quantity and needing more, more, more. But that last story made a good point. If we can learn how to shift our thoughts to understanding that perhaps we don't need to spend our money on an extra cheeseburger, but rather on a quality piece of meat, it might solve our challenges of obesity and budgets. NPR recently reported that the sugar industry paid for a study to shift the blame of obesity from sugar to fat content. We've since learned that sugar can also cause a host of health issues, including obesity. And perhaps we're witnessing another shift from cheap processed foods to more nutritious whole foods. Just like we can focus on acquiring things that have true value, which doesn't always mean acquiring things that cost more, I think we lose something when we shift our value from people and humanity to obtaining money for better or bigger things. I think there are people here in Appalachia who value people and humanity more than money, plain and simple. And maybe that's another reason we've been seen as an other. But that's okay with me. I've always wanted to be unique anyways. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, and the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Our music this week was provided by Dinosaur Burps and Michael Howard. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy helps with promotions. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. And visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There, you can also subscribe to the podcast or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.